Hello and welcome to the Hansen Hour podcast, where we spend an hour or thereabouts deep diving into the band Hansen. I'm your host, Megan, and you can join in with me and a special guest each week as we talk about a range of Hansen-related topics. I'm so excited that you are here to join in on this, so grab a cuppa or a glass of red and settle in for an hour of fun. It's guaranteed to make you smile.
One, two, three.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of season 1 of the Hansen Hour. My name is Megan and I have been holding out waiting for this interview to happen. I was crossing all my fingers and toes that everything would align for me and my next guest just to get this one recorded. So I'd like to introduce JD O'Regan, who is a co-author of a book with her husband called Hooks in Popular Music. Now, I'm sorry, but to help our listeners understand, I'm going to actually read the description that I got off Booktopia. Is that all right with you guys? We're just going to go for it. All right. So this book is the first book. So is there going to be another? Are we going book 2? It's the first.
Yes, thank you. It's possibly part 2.
Length study of Hooks in Popular Music. Hooks are those memorable musical moments for listeners, such as a riff or a catchy melodic phrase. And they're arguably the guiding principle of much modern popular music. The concept of the hook involves aspects of melody, rhythm, harmony, production, lyrical and cultural meaning, and how these interact with the song's top line and backing track. I just want to add, it also says hooks are also inherently related to the human capacities for memory and attention and interact with our previous experiences in popular music, which I think is a really important point that we're going to try and touch on a little bit today. JD also teaches Bachelor of Music Studies at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. And in 2014, she was awarded her PhD, which randomly, as us Hansen fans will all know, focused on the development of the distinctive sound of the Beach Boys between 1962 and 1966. And also, she's a musician and a songwriter herself. So, JD, thank you for being here and welcome to the Hansen Hour.
Hi, Megan. Lovely to meet you. Thanks for having me. This is very exciting. Thanks for making me sound so smart.
It was probably the longest intro I've had, but I wanted to get it right because I think that there's so much goodness here, and that's why I've been so excited about this one, because you really do know your stuff, and you're someone that I really, really, really wanted on to talk about it all. So, but first things first, I just want to hear about your experience, because you were actually a fan back in the day, right? And you've got some early Hansen memories.
I do, yeah. So I was a fan back at the beginning, so in 1997, and the way I found out about them, I had a friend at school, and she came to school with this sort of poster of these cute boys on her notebook, and I was like, what's happening here? Who are they? And she said, I heard this song and I'm obsessed. And that little kind of A4 poster, I think, was ripped out of a TV guide or something, or like a at the time. And I was like, okay. And then I heard the song on the radio and was obsessed. I just thought, and that was Mbop, that was the first song that I heard. Yeah, I just it had so many things that I loved about music, and it was also a way that, like, I connected with a lot of my friends at the time. Like, we had a little gang, yes, who all loved this music, and yeah, we were right in the fandom. I had a lot of the money I spent on magazines
Yes.
Back in the day. So many smash hits, so many Top of the Pops, all that kind of stuff. So I was absolutely in there as a fan. I didn't get to see them until the year 2000. So I'm in Australia like you are, and I grew up in Queensland on the Gold Coast. And so that first promotional tour, as I recall, I was really only in Melbourne and Sydney. So I didn't get to experience there. But look, truly, my heartbreak about that was very deep. And then I think they toured in 2000, and I saw them play at the in Brisbane at the River Stage, which was an outdoor, stadium sort of thing. And so that was the first time I got to see them. It was, I want to say, like 40 degrees, and it was probably the most insane crowd I think I've ever been in. I actually still have a scar on my abdomen. Insane it was, of just people scrambling. So it's like of all the gigs I've been to.
Yeah, you got the damage at the Hanson gig out of all the gigs you've been to. So what? How did you get a scar on your abdomen?
Just everyone was insane. They were like trying to climb to the front and push each other out of the way, and I got this insane bruise. Anyway, battle scars. And then like kind of after that, my friend group kind of, we all went to uni and we drifted away and I sort of lost the thread, I guess, with Hanson in a way. But there are very few times in your life where you love something so fiercely as you do when you're 13. And I just feel like I was in the perfect place, the perfect time, the perfect friendships around me, where suddenly this was a music that made sense to me and felt like it was mine. So, yeah, it was me back in 1997, old school.
Because your husband, Dr. Tim Bryan, he's a music psychologist as well from the University of Wollongong, and he's actually here with us today. And a little bit later, we're going to try and move into a discussion about that sort of psychology behind a lot of that strong emotion, I suppose, that links in with music, which I've always found really interesting and have tried to do a little bit of my own research, actually, just for fun. Into why I always found it a really interesting topic, like why was I having that response? Why do I still have that response? And I suppose what's going on psychologically that I tried to do a little bit of work on. So I'm interested to hear what Tim says about that when we get to it, to see if it matches up with what Google told me. So
Dr. Tim's sitting next to me here. He's here too.
My voice jump in. We're very lucky to have both here. So also, let's just get straight into it. So your understanding of hooks, what makes Mbop so catchy? What was it about Mbop in particular that just made it so catchy with its hooks?
Do you want me to jump into this one? Okay. I think there are a number of things. We mentioned them as an example in the book quite a few times, actually, for different reasons. So in our study of hooks, we referred to, I guess, a hook, a general definition, is something that stands out and is easily remembered. And it can be one of those things or both of those things. And so I think there's like maybe a myth that the hook of a song is just like the chorus. But we actually think hooks can be in all parts of a song, you know, verses, choruses, you know, and the most successful songs often have hooks that are happening in all parts of the song. In fact, there's a famous quote we refer to in the book this is an amazing book called The Song Machine by John Seabrook, if you want some references after this podcast. And there's a quote in it from Jay Brown, who was the head of Roc Nation, Jay-Z's record label, who said, you know, in modern pop, you have to have a hook every 7 seconds because that's how long somebody will give it before they flick the dial, essentially. Obviously Mbop was not, you know, is not necessarily modern pop these days, as much as my brain wants to pretend I'm not nearing 40. But I do think that particular song was successful for so many ways. Some of those are musical, and I think some of those are cultural too, actually. So I mean, the main hook, the phrase Mbop, again, particularly stands out because it's not a real word. Well, I mean, I think they defined it as a moment in time, or a measure of time. But it's not a word that you're used to hearing. And so I think that immediately makes people go, sorry, what's happening here? So that is a kind of a hook that draws you in. It's also using in the chorus the use of, I guess, what we would call nonsense syllables. And so by that I mean, you know, ba-do-ba-dot, ba-do-bop. And that has a really long history in pop, right? So like those kind of vocables really stem back to like vocal music of the 40s and 50s, doo-wop music, of which I assume Hanson were really big fans of that kind of singing, mm-hmm. Because they certainly drew from that musically. And so the reason those vocables were in the early music is because it was almost all vocal. There were no instruments. And in fact, the people making that music couldn't afford instruments. So those bop, bop, doot, doo took the place of where an instrument would go, right? But it's, you see it filtered into pop music again through the Beach Boys. You know, there's a lot of great hooks that don't have words. And I think because it doesn't have words, they're easy to sing, it's fun, it stands out. And so I think those use of those nonsense syllables in the chorus of Umbop are particularly effective. There's also the sound of their voices in a way. Like there were a lot of boy bands happening in the 90s, I think, but there weren't a lot of them that one played their own instruments. So I think that was certainly a visual hook that's made them stand out. And they also sounded so tiny. They sounded like kids because they were kids. And so I think the sound of those voices was also a kind of, it was also kind of a draw. And the way that those voices blended together so beautifully, like there's just something about family singing together. They're blend, their harmony blend, which you can almost, it's hard to distinguish which voice is which. And that's something that really only happens when the literal like vocal cords are built in similarly genetically in that sort of way. So the Beach Boys have it, and you know, the Bee Gees have it, that kind of stuff that
yeah, Crowded House still
exactly like Crowded that, House yeah. have it yeah. So there's just something beautiful about family voices singing together. And then of course there's that cool riff at the front of it that's really catchy, that kind of goes through. Oh yeah, yeah. Maybe I'll get out my friend. It's my friend Cassie, the Casio from the 80s. But it's like, where is it? Is it in A? Oh, that's an interesting sound. You know, that riff that goes over and over again. Incredibly catchy. It picks out the chord progression. But yeah, it's like immediate. It's like an immediate arpeggiated kind of riff that draws you in. Also, use of keyboards. A lot of keyboards on that song too, in terms of its sound. And we're coming out of grunge. We're coming into like alternative music, yeah. Essentially, where guitar was the king of instruments, right? And here we have a band that, yes, has guitars in it, but also has a lot of keyboards as a feature. Like Middle of Nowhere has heaps of keyboards on it. It's got like clav, Hammond organs, it's got like pianos, like whirlies, it's got all of the, and I think as a piano player that attracted me too, you know, it's like, oh, that's my instrument, I can relate to that. So I mean, I could go on, but there are a bunch of the hooks I think in that made it particularly successful at that time.
That's incredible, and I think you've unpacked that so well. And what I'm sort of hearing too is, in a way, and I might be wrong, but this is sort of what I'm picking up, in a way it's more the hook can be the overall package as well. So we do have the hook, like in terms of a music, but like you're talking about, you know, mm-hmm. they looked a particular way, they were brothers, we are coming out of that grunge, or we're still sort of in that grunge era, but that younger crowd are looking for something to love as much as Kurt Cobain, or you know, as much as maybe their older siblings, and people are looking,
yep.
And that was sort of their answer, and it was so wholesome that it sort of seemed to be so go into the stratosphere for all those reasons. That was just it aligned, right? Like you can't deny that they're very good
totally,
at
yeah.
what they do, and that they are very incredibly talented, and obviously stood the test of time. But it's almost like I remember reading in my undergrad, which was in music, a book called The Tipping Point, and we talked about what sort of makes yeah. something tip over, and it is that sort of build up that's happening even in a society to make something move across that tipping point to get it to that point. So that hook is music, but it is also a range of other things that are coming into play that make it go, you know, crazy.
Yeah, and I think you could make the comparison to like the Beatles and then the Monkees. So like the Monkees, who are amazing, but they were kind of like the favorite band of the younger kids in the family who loved the Beatles like 4 years previous or 5 years previous or something. So, you know, it's bubblegum, right? Like that's a term that doesn't get used in pop music very much these days. But Mbop is a perfect example of bubblegum pop, which was like music that is youthful and for young people and speaks to them. Now, of course, like the 60s version of bubblegum is probably a bit more childish in some ways. It was sort of literally about bubblegum a lot. There's a lot of candy, you know, like Sugar Sugar by the Archies or like, you know, or I Want Candy or something like that. But like, with Hanson, they certainly have the kind of bubblegum aesthetic in that they're really young people, but they were singing like pop songs that people could relate to. It wasn't just sort of about candy, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like with in 1996 with Mbop, there's something about the sound of that.
97. Yeah, I'm going to fact check.
Okay, yeah. so there's something that about the sound the of that argument, at the yeah. time.
Not at all.
No. There's something about the sound of Hanson in sort of 1997, which is a pretty new sound. Like if you think about like what just straightforward commercial pop sounds like, around the mid-90s, you get like that there is stuff like the boy band stuff, which is very shiny in a certain kind of way. You get stuff like I don't know, like George Michael's Fast Love, perhaps, that kind of quite R&B influenced and kind of and very
shiny,
intricate and, but also shiny. And I feel like there's a kind of music that is starting to happen towards the end of the 90s, which you might also put in, say, Smash Mouth or Sugar Ray or like, which is kind of, it's alternative influenced, I guess, but it's really a kind of pop. So you get stuff like that or Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus or, you know, these kind of like bits of pop music that are and I feel like that Mbop is quite one of the first songs that kind of has that kind of sound to it where it's shiny, but it's got a sense of kind of, there's a warmth to the sound of it.
There's an organic sense about it because they're like, they're real instruments other than maybe the scratchy.
Yeah.
But there is like, that sounds like a band in a room.
Yeah.
Playing together. Mm-hmm.
But it also sounds modern in a way that say the bubblegum of the 1960s doesn't.
Exactly.
So grunge has happened. You can kind of hear that in the music, but it isn't that. And I think that's part of the attraction of Mbop as well, that kind of people heard that sound, it sounded different to everything else, but it was also familiar enough. Like it's not a complicated song in that kind of way. It's not like you have to understand 10 other songs to know how it works. It's immediate in that kind of way, but the sound is also a little bit new as well.
Yeah, and I think that might have something to do with like the use of like the Dust Brothers as the producers. Like this, they certainly have like, you know, pop aesthetics, but they'd also just recorded with Beck, right?
They didn't do, we've just talked about this in the pod too, they ended up leaving midway, so they produced a couple songs but then found the Beastie Boys, right, which is similar again, like that sort of really different, it's similar but different sounding of the time, and ended up going and working with the Beastie Boys without finishing Middle of Nowhere.
That's right. But it definitely still has some of their kind of indie alt kind of coolness, even though it's, like draped in this kind of very shiny pop in a way. Like that's such a good point, Kim. Like I wouldn't have thought of that, which I really like.
And it's true. I think Hanson have always said that, like someone asked them about once on a podcast about connecting with boy bands and being a boy band, and they've never seen themselves like that because they really did call their peers, like Beck and Ben Queller and people like that were sort of the people that they associated with, the people that they called their peers. Aerosmith, those bands, they found that they held more resonance with. And again, like they just didn't really seem it was unique, it was different, they didn't fit in, but they were kids, it was Oh my God, I was just going to say it was really weird, but then what a weird reference to Hanson.
Hey, great.
Did you also write a book? Because my research might be off here, but did you also write a book called Can't Get You Out of My Head? Or did you have...
That's actually one of the... No, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's one of the chapters actually in our book, which is called Hooks in Popular Music. So you're on it. That which came out in December of last year. And so that, as you mentioned at the top, was a book that Tim and I co-wrote together, like myself as a pop musicologist and Tim as a music psychologist. That particular chapter, which we named after that very excellent Kylie Minogue song, was actually all about Tim's research in like where I come from in terms of like songwriting and production. You know, hooks are a musical thing, but where Tim comes from in his research, he sees hooks as like a psychological phenomenon and the idea of the earworm. Like, why does something get stuck in our head? And often those bits are hooks. But I might just let Tim maybe speak to some of the stuff from that chapter if you're interested.
Shoot some questions at you around that, because in that you sort of explore a little bit how music stands out to a listener, like we were just saying, and sort of creates these things called earworms. So in a way, does this sort of link fans together as having similar processing or even psychological similarities, or could it explain how some people gravitate towards particular hooks and styles of music based on our sort of psychology or our processing or our minds in a way?
Yeah, so I guess the thing about an earworm is that if you've got an earworm stuck in your head, at some level what your brain has done has taken the experience you have of hearing the song, and it's turned that into some sort of encoding. It's encoded that in some kind of way and kept that as a memory. And so at some level, what's happening when you have that song stuck in your head is that it's come back from your memories back into your consciousness. And so for that to happen, there's a variety of parts of that. But part of it is that some songs for some people are probably going to be the ones that get them based on their previous experiences with music. So what we find in research on earworms is that at any particular point, you might expect that lots and lots of people have the number one single in the country and as the song stuck in their head. But that's not what we really find. Most of the time, the songs that are stuck in people's heads are very individual to them. And they're probably about basically what they've been listening to recently, more or less most of the time. And so, So if you are having the same song stuck in your heads as other people, it probably just means you're listening to the similar music and you're noticing similar things about the music. I guess one of the things about hooks, which are sort of the things that become earworms in a way, I think one of the things about hooks is that the hooks can be in different parts of music, and I think different people listen to different parts of music. Like some people are more focused on the lyrics, some people are more focused on the rhythm, some people might be more focused on melody. And so I think if you are having the same bit stuck in your head as someone else, it probably suggests you're listening to music in relatively similar ways, I would say. Mm-hmm. But that's also probably something that more research can be done on to look at how exactly that works.
Yeah, because it can also be, and particularly in the case of something like Mbop, and because we understand now through this conversation that hook is visual as well. There was something so polarizing about Mbop where people had those positive experiences where they were earworms and they were like, this is great, and like they loved it. But then you can also get that really negative experience of people that were so angry about it. And if that song did get stuck in their head, they were, there was an emotion that wasn't always positive. So I guess that plays into some sort of psychology as well, that maybe if they were listening to metal and they had Mbop, that made them feel, I don't know, like really unmasculine.
Yeah. I mean, that's the power of a good hook. It will get you despite how you feel about it. It's going to like live in your brain. Too bad.
I guess like you think about the teenage brothers of the Hanson fans who are like hearing that song and going, this isn't for me, and more wanting to go back and listen to their Metallica or whatever.
Sorry, Jason. That's my brother who had to listen to a lot of Hanson. Yeah. Sorry.
Like, chances are they've mostly been growing up listening to the same music as their sisters. And so they will have heard the same kind of songs that lead their sisters to like Hanson, like based on their experience, based on like how what they the new things they listen to, how they relate to old things and so forth. But they, you know, their personalities and their kind of where they want to be situated culturally and all that kind of stuff is going to be different. So for example, your brother.
So it's a bit silly, right? Like it's a little bit silly for a teenage brother, if we're looking at cultural and societal values in terms of a male and a female, we can really come back into like, you know, not whether it's right or wrong back then, like maybe it was a little bit silly. My sister's into this song, actually don't mind it. And I am getting it stuck in my head, but am I going to go out and admit that as a teenage male? No. When all my mates are like, these Hanson brothers, like they're not going to do that. So.
Well, I think, and I think it's interesting reflecting on that in the 90s to say how pop music is treated these days. I think with Hanson, a lot of the backlash against them and their visual identity in a way is I got a lot of, well, they just look like girls.
Sure.
Right. There's a lot of like, almost, it was almost like recoiling in a weirdly like homophobic way, in a way, like that they didn't present a kind of masculinity that was popular at that particular point. Do you know what I mean? And so in like a non-threatening masculinity in a way, which so of course it was popular with young girls, that's a safe space in a way. So whereas these days, I think, you know, maybe with someone like Harry Styles, there's lots of male fans, lots of female fans, lots of queer fans, lots of LGBT fans. Like that's like, I just feel like pop fans these days don't have such a problem with that kind of thing. Like people just like pop music because it's pop music and that's fine. There's no guilty pleasure about it. Whereas I think in the 90s you might say, oh yeah, I really like that song, but I wouldn't let my friends know. There's a weird shame in there. And I think that is to do with, you know, misogyny, and I think it's to do with homophobia too in some ways, about like them representing a kind of masculinity that wasn't cool or in. Or whereas these days I think if you had a pop band that looked like them, no one would, it wouldn't actually be part of the debate, hopefully, you know.
Sign of the times, again, not to like randomly throw Harry Styles you know, sign of the times in there, but it is a sign of the times. And Harry Styles, you know, has just gone on to win Grammy for best album this year. And for someone that is incredibly, in my eyes, masculine, but can wear feather boas and glitter and black nail polish and that goes on to win a Grammy, I'm so thankful that here we are moving forward as a culture where that is not only acceptable, that's actually rarely even a discussion now. Like, you know, the only discussion that came out of it is the feminine. Because he's a white male, there was a lot of backlash about him actually even. He needed to apologize, basically, get up there, which is, again, we have some ways to go. But in terms of some of our problems in society, I feel like we are moving forward in a really good direction, having really good conversations. Anyway.
I just don't think that's part of it for sure. So I'm glad we got to acknowledge some of that.
So I guess from the perspective of earworms, going back to all that conversation. I guess from that perspective, like at that point, it's going to be on the radio a lot. So the teenage brothers are going to be hearing it as well, and they're going to get it stuck in their heads, but they may not like it quite as much.
It was number one for a while.
Yeah, it was.
Until I want to say Meredith Brooks knocked it off the number one spot. Do you remember that, Megan?
Which song? Is that the song you're talking about? Oh my God.
Yes. I'm pretty sure that was the one.
So I did just look it up. So it went number one in 12 countries, and it was the only song to date that they were Grammy nominated, awarded at Grammy nominated for. Yes. Anyway, all right. So do we think that Hanson, are they really good at their job? Do they write? I mean, you guys, you don't know specifically, but do you reckon they write for their fans, knowing about what these sort of earworms and what hooks we're going to gravitate towards? Or do we just have similar, like, processing as them do you know what I mean? Like organically to create a fan base, what's the sort of foundation to create a fan base? Are they writing because they're really smart and they know what's going to hook us in, or are they writing and it just happens organically that we then resonate with it? What's your take?
Both, most likely. Like, I mean, there's lots of people involved in making something like Mbop work. It's them writing it. It's whoever's producing it. If the Dust Brothers did, or if they kind of left halfway through and someone else did, or whatever. So there's various people involved in the process, and there's like the record company saying, "Yes, release this one as a single rather than that one." There's all those kind of stuff, because they're sort of sitting there going, "Well, this is the one that's going to work this week." You know, maybe in 6 months' time, when some other album's been released, people are going to know what that sound is meant to mean, and we can release that single. But you know, those kind of things are possibly there. But I think musicians in general, they want to communicate. But that's sort of like a big thing of what it is to be a musician. They're trying to communicate like feelings and emotions to other people, and they're using the skills they have at their disposal to try and do that.
That's a really good point.
I think like to get someone's attention, to get something that's going to stay in someone's memory, that's a good form of communication. That means your message is being taken in.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's definitely a real skill in pop music of having that message that can be taken in that kind of way.
Yeah, I have some thoughts about this. Songwriting wise, like, I think that's a very cool question, actually, because it's like that's actually a very complicated question in a good way, I think. But if I think about what I know about them as songwriters, and I guess I'm going back to the early days, they were like pop scholars. Like, they loved popular music. Like, they clearly had a family and parents who loved pop music. They grew up on, you know, like the Beatles and Motown, and like they love, like, I remember them talking about, like, I really love Steve Winwood. Like, what 13-year-old is like, I love Steve Winwood or whatever? Spencer Davis and stuff like that. And like, it's just, you know, they had some really interesting points of reference. And what that tells me is that they were like brought up in a house that was filled with amazing classic pop songwriting. And so there's something weirdly timeless in a way. Like, of course, the production makes it sound like it's 1997 or whatever, or like, you know, songs from like this time around, like sounds like the year 2000 or whatever. But the songwriting choices they make, the chord progressions they use, the use of melody, the structural stuff that's underpinning it is, you know, what we'd refer to as just like straight up classic pop songwriting. And I think on Middle of Nowhere, there's some of that because of the people they worked with. So like, I Will Come to You, which was single, was that third, fourth single maybe, was written with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who you know, you and your listeners might know is like songwriting royalty in pop. They were songwriters in the Brill Building. So for those
I did try and get them on. No one got back to me. I do have one.
No, please, can I come back on?
I've got one, like, one guest who has given me a yes, but her manager is umming and ahhing about it, and I won't say too much, but someone that wrote some of my classics, like some Belinda Carlisle, "Don't Leave the Light." I don't know, I won't say anything else, but I'm like just crossing everything for that as well. So we'll see, but I am hoping to, because circling back, and then I'll let you take over. They did write with some prolific songwriters for Middle of Nowhere. So anyway, come on. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil as like being people like from the Brill Building who wrote like heaps of amazing girl group songs and like
You've Lost That Loving Feeling.
Yes. What an honor. And I get the feeling that because they were, you know, so intelligent about the history of pop, they of course knew the weight of that. But they also wrote with people like Desmond Child, who I want to say wrote Living on a Prayer. Yeah. And La Vida Loca, maybe?
It's a very classic pop kind of, like, of the 80s and 90s. It has a very different sound to the 60s stuff.
Yeah. And again, they were both singles. Like, I think he worked on, I want to say Weird. Can you check my work for me, Megan?
So I've just done Weird. What was it? And I should know because I'm unpacking them all right now. Yeah, it was Weird. Oh, my God. Good. I just did it and I didn't even mention it. Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah. And he did really
and like because that, like, those two songs have, like, a really specific chord progression that you just wouldn't hear in modern pop anymore. Like, there's a real focus on melody and on harmony. But, and by that, I mean, like, chord progressions and the melody of the vocal. Like, that just isn't – like, the things that are important in pop, modern pop these days are much more to do with texture and rhythm. And so that's what I feel like gives their songs that kind of weirdly timeless feel about it, is that they're like they're based on these very long held songwriting structures and rules, I guess. And so that's what I hear. That's definitely what I like, even hearing those songs as an adult, like as a much more grown up person, I can go, oh, I see the craft in there now. Like, and that's the thing. Like, I think there's a tension between, like, if something's popular and formulaic, that therefore it's no good. But the craft of a perfect song, of which Mbop is a good example, I think Where's the Love's a great example of a perfectly crafted little pop gem. You know, there's so much talent and skill in, like, making something relate to so many people. Like, the fact that that's not acknowledged is weird to me, no pun intended.
So I feel, though, we're moving into a time where acknowledgement is coming, because for me, you know, I wish I could be one of those people that was like, it's about the music, guys. It's not about them. It's about the music. No, for me, definitely, until I became an adult, it really probably wasn't about the music. It was about the feeling. It was about the emotion. It was about how attractive they were. It was all those things. The music specifically, probably not so much. But now as an adult, that I'm obviously married and I have children, and that has passed, it does come back to the music for me. And someone I was talking on a pod the other day about how underrated they are, and you've just summed it up, both of you actually, there's 2 points, summed it up by saying how incredible they are as songwriters, and that it stood the test of time. They stand true to their songwriting abilities, and they do something still to this day that isn't really out there, you know, in a way that, you know, it's not being played on the radio. They're not getting airplay. They're not sort of not pulling the amount of, say, top 40s that they were in terms of single releases. But their music is genuinely incredible. And I know my husband, who is into a lot of like Ryan Adams and things like that, he absolutely loves them. You know, they're a great, great band. Comes to all their live shows and really thoroughly enjoys it. And it's not even silly to him. Do you know, like, some people go and you can see the husbands that are standing there and it's all just so silly. But for him, like, you can recognize that it's a really good, they're fantastic at what they do and incredible songwriters. And then, Tim, circling back to what you were saying in terms of artists just want to be able to communicate, that's something that as we've aged, and we've aged along with the band, we're now starting to see that communication was all about really giving back, and their way of being of service was to stay true to their, I guess, their message in their music, which is about, you know, being proud of yourself and going out there and taking risks and, you know, just how worthy you are. And I think that was a really important point. And I didn't realize, even listening back to those early songs of Middle of Nowhere, they had that even then. And they haven't changed, you know, that communication. And it's almost like it's what you need. The world is friggin' burning down all around you, but then you've got this incredible music that holds you and makes you feel like actually it's going to be all right. And it's so powerful.
Yeah, and I think that is a trend in pop even now. Like with stuff like Harry Styles or like Lizzo or something, who like all of their songs are really about like being okay with who you are and like being openly okay with that stuff. Like it was just very not cool to do that in the 90s. Like in the 90s it was like whatever, like don't care about anything. Yeah. Like there was a, you know, eye-rolly sarcastic kind of flick everything, and like God love it. Please love the 90s. But yeah, I think the point you made that was super important in what you just said was that they aged with their fans. I think that's a rare thing for an artist to like be 13 or 15 or 16 or whatever, and or 11 or whatever, and then grow up with that, because if you look at the songs on, say, Middle of Nowhere, they're about stuff that kids relate to, that young people would relate to. There's, you know, one about a yearbook, there's one about losing a family member, there's one about, you know, what are we going to be when we grow up, like who are the people that matter in my life, there's about not fitting in. It's like all of these themes are so accessible to somebody at that particular age, and I know they certainly resonated with me. Like, I know you said, like, back in the day it was like more about who they are and like the fandom stuff. For me, it actually really was about the music. I learned a lot about how pop music worked by writing charts about their songs. Like, I was like, what are these chord progressions, why do I like it, I want to figure it out. So I was a real nerd about it, let's just say. But I did like Taylor the best, sorry. But I do have a thing for keyboard players, because, like, I married one, so clearly I have a type. But, yeah, I think that idea of, like, aging up with your fans and making them part of that process of maturing and reaching adulthood, and, like, they're going through the same things as their fans. Like you said, you're married, you've got kids, that's their experience too. There's something really beautiful and very fragile and special about that, in a way that, like, a lot of bands don't get to do. And I think that's why they're so fiercely loved, is that they feel that connection of your life is like my life. And like you said, in a world that's on fire, that's a safe place, you know. That's what music can do.
And there is something interesting about, like, a, you know, being a 13-year-old and having a crush on someone who's 14 or 15 or something like that, as opposed to a 24-year-old, because if you think about that relationship between the 14-year-old and the 13-year-old, between the 24-year-old and the 14-year-old, if it actually happened, that would be gross and creepy.
Problematic. But, I mean, that's what boy bands did, right, Megan? Like, if you think of, like, a boy band, like the Backstreet Boys, for example, they were, no shade to the Backstreet Boys, they have some great pop-tastic hits for sure, they're in the book. But they were manufactured, in a way that each of them represented a type of masculinity. Like, there was, like, the Nick Carter, who was like, he's the pretty boy, he's cute, you know, you take him home to meet your mum. And then there was, you know, like, the bad boy who's like a bit edgy, and then there's the sort of very soft-spoken one. Or, like, I mean, you could say the same about the Beatles. There was, like, the funny one and the cute one and the shy one and the whatever. Like, they're representing these types of masculinity. I mean, Hanson are an interesting one, because they really weren't that, because they were family in a way. Like, they didn't have those kinds of, like, slot into these different things that, like, young women could sort of like imprint on them in that sort of way. And I mean that in a genuine, loving kind of way. So yeah, I do think that they're interesting in the culture of, like, say, a boy band. And, like, I'm not against manufactured music. The Sex Pistols are manufactured, just saying. But yeah, they're an interesting one, in that they there was a genuineness about their representation and who they are, you know. It's very hard to put on an act when you're a kid too. Like, how do you craft a persona at that age? Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a grown-up thing to have to think about.
Yeah. We talked a little bit before. You were saying that you were someone who actually really did identify with the music. And I was saying, for me, particularly at that young age, you know, in my early teens, for me, it was definitely about the emotional response that I was having that hooked me in. So can we talk a little bit about linking music with emotion, and how, you know, I've heard the band talk a lot about people that sort of come up to them and tell them these really, you know, these stories about, you know, this song saved my life, or, you know, how much this means to me, and how that sort of puts them in a really hard spot, because they weren't actually there at that time, even though their music is there. It's not actually them personally. But we seem to have these, like, emotional responses to music, and we seem to really, you know, I don't know, put a lot of stock into songs and music to save us, or to be, you know, the savior. So how important is that in terms of linking that emotion with music? Like, how is this happening?
that's quite a complicated question.
It's huge. I love it. That's like a PhD thesis question. Yeah. Come and be a doctor with us.
that is a complicated question. So So I'll do what I can. But,
yeah, do what you can, Dr. Tim.
So when you listen to a bit of music, you basically have a set of expectations about what is going to happen in that music, based on all the other music you've listened to over the course of your life. And even if you're 13 and hearing Mbop for the first time, you probably listen to thousands and thousands of hours of music by that point. Some of that's going to be the music on like Sesame Street. Some of that's going to be like pop music of the era. Some of that's going to be like the things your parents listen to, et cetera, et cetera. And so as a result of that, you've got a set of expectations about what's going to happen next.
And I should say, it doesn't matter if you're a musician or not.
Yeah.
You innately know some of this stuff through the processing of your music.
Yeah. So basically, you're going to know that if you hear a C chord and then you hear an F chord, probably the next chord might be a G chord.
Even if you don't know what an F and a G chord is.
Yeah, even if you don't know what those things are.
Yeah.
And so what happens when you have music like that, that you come and listen to, when you do listen to that, because you have those expectations, if you think about expectations at the level of just everyday life expectations, you expect something to happen, you're hoping for something to happen, you're dreading something to happen, and whether those things happen make you feel stuff. Whether the things you expect come to happen, it makes you feel certain ways. If you feel the sense of relief if the thing you dread doesn't happen, or you feel the sense of joy if the thing you're hoping for does happen.
Mm.
And it's kind of the same when you listen to music. So when you listen to music, you've got all these expectations about what's going to happen. But what's interesting also about music is that those expectations based on what usually happens in music are different from knowing the song. So the song that you know, like once you come to know the song, you kind of have this set of expectations of, you know, that you're expecting this thing to happen and that will make you feel a certain way if it does, and you're expecting this thing to happen and that will make you feel that way if it does. But you also know the song after a while, after you've listened to it for a few times, and that will make you, it has this nice, the combination of those two things means you do feel things when you listen to music, even though you know how it goes. You have those expectations, and that makes you feel the things you feel when you listen to music.
I imagine it's like, you know, if you have like a comfort TV show or something, and you know all the lines, you could say it off by heart, but there is something very deeply comforting to go back there and feel those feelings every time, in that sort of way. I definitely think. But also, I mean, there are absolutely psychological processes that Tim is talking about here in terms of like tension and release, or like expectation and then whether that expectation is met or not met. But I also think one of the beautiful things about pop music is that it can be deeply personal, right? So like a hook, like there's big dumb hooks in Mbop that are supposed to be there, or Where's the Love or whatever, that are absolutely supposed to be there. But then there are just moments in a song, like a turn of phrase or a different chord progression, or like when an instrument comes in, that just get you. And maybe there isn't a psychological or scientific reason behind it. And that's what makes it so beautiful, is that it's like, despite all of this, it's still resonating with you. Like there are chord progressions I hear and they go, oh, they hurt, but they hurt in a beautiful way, and I want to keep listening to them in that sort of way. Like so I do think that there's definitely, you know, reasons why we emotionally relate to music, because I think music, like Tim said, music is about communication of ideas and feelings and that sort of stuff, and you know, we are open to receiving those feelings. But there's also just some deeply, like, I'm sure, Megan, you've got like some Hanson song that you love that maybe they never play and nobody ever talks about, but it's just special because you like it, or it's something that you experienced with a friend, or it was playing during a particular point in your life that you go back to. And there's like, there's deeply personal links to emotion in music that aren't always, yeah, like on the
one note following
exactly
another.
Yeah. I don't know if I explained that very well, but you know what I mean.
We'll know this in the fandom for everyone listening. We often will talk about saying they're the soundtrack of our lives, you know, and there is something because we did grow up with them. And each time you pop one particular album on, you're transported back to that particular time, which weirdly matched, you know, where they were in their lives as well. So, you know, it really is a soundtrack of our life, dependent on what album we're listening to at the time. And I think what I'm hearing from you guys too is how, I suppose, important it is to feel that you're seen, and that you can, it's almost like you have to in terms of being identified, or your identity can link in with it, or and that builds a lot of the resonance around as well. And you know, JD, you keep bringing up safe spaces, and I think that that's something that's really important too that I haven't really touched on before, is that that's also really comforting as well. I'm seen, and I see my identity in this, and just, you know, how important that is as a human and as a species to really find yourself. Yes. To belong, you know?
We all want to connect. We all want to be validated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, what you were talking about before, about that weird kind of tension between, you know, a fan going, you've saved my life and you don't even know, and them being like, cool, thank you. And like, and how weird that is, being like, yeah, you know, we love you, we understand, but also I don't know you. I mean, that's like, I guess what you would call parasocial relationships. And I don't know if that's come up in the people you've been talking to, but there's, you know, some interesting research about that, especially in the wake of social media, where like, mm-hmm, as fans, these people that you love are accessible in a weird way that they weren't. Can you imagine how insane I would have been in 1997 if I could have like followed Hanson on Twitter? Like, I'm so glad I did. Can you imagine what I would have done at 13? But I just mean like, they're accessible in a way, and I mean any musician or any, you know, celebrity that you love are accessible in a way. So it's easy to think, God, they're just there. They're right there. But yeah, it is, again, a parasocial thing that isn't, doesn't go both ways. But through the music, you do feel like it is, and that's what's beautiful. Absolutely. About it. You feel like you're with a friend.
Yes. Yeah. So even now, like, as a, I'm not 40 yet, but I'm an almost 40 year old, when I attend shows of Hanson, right? And this is totally, I'm a positive Hanson fan. I love every single part of this community, the good and the maybe negative, all the things, you know. This is not, I love it all, and we all make up different parts of the community, but I do see, you know, patterns of behavior from, say, when I was in my teens, I see really similar patterns of behavior. So, you know how you talked at the start about having your little scar from the pushing and the shoving?
My battle scar, my hands in the battle scar.
Absolutely happens to this day. So we're talking a lot about, say, physical, getting very physical with each other, or a very strong need to be a very strong need to be in the front row, to be close. And there's a couple of things, you know, as a huge music fan myself, you get a very different energy being up the front, say, you do with the back. So that definitely does play into it. There's all different reasons why people want to do it, and it does link again back into that emotion, because it feels good. When Hanson are on tour and we're following them around and we're all, you know, clamoring for that front row, there's something about it that is so nostalgic, that is so a lot, you feel alive, you feel happy, it's your safe space, you're there, you know, you're performing. But there can be, you know, these patterns of behavior. People still cry. A lot of women tend to, like, even in their 40s, tend to overdrink at the shows and can end up, you know, say, vomiting and passed out in the toilet, which is a pattern of behavior, again, that's very associated with maybe being a teenager. So what would sort of make you know, that brain fire in a way to make these patterns continue to come up, that possibly you're very quite normal in your average life, but then, say, when you're at a Hanson show, you're maybe a different version of yourself, or you're doing things or finding yourself in situations that possibly you wouldn't do otherwise. I won't give you any examples of that.
I want, give me all the goss. Megan, were you in the toilet at the back?
You know what happens to us?
Yeah, so I think with people's behavior, it's often more influenced by the situation around them than people think. I think people think that they have, you know, this very defined personality that is who they are. But a lot of that is sometimes about, like, the situation that they're in. And so you will know that there's people who, you know, that they act very, very differently around their kids than they do when their friends are there and their kids are not there. And so people kind of are very much creatures of their situation. And so I think it's also the case that, like, the memories that we have, and so therefore the options to act that might come into our heads are going to influence that as well. And so, like, so when you are in this situation where you where you've been before, and it's been a while since you've thought that way, it's easier to access the kind of the memories of what you did last time, or the, and so therefore the kind of the options of how you might behave in this situation compared to others. And so I think that's going to play a role there, like that you are a, yeah, the person you are, that there is a core to you, but like you can be quite different in one situation to another. And that's like one particular situation that because you're not in that situation that often, it does bring you back to earlier times that you, when you were in that situation before, that you probably haven't thought about for a very long time.
Yeah, I also think music's like a weird, like a time machine.
Yeah, music plays a role, definitely. Yeah.
You know, like when you hear a song and it just goes, whoosh, 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 and like suddenly you're like at school eating lunch, and you're like very specific memory in that sort of way. And I guess I compare your examples here of like, have you ever got together with a bunch of friends that you met in a very specific situation, and then when you all get together, you're like personal jokes and funny things from that time, or like, you know, if you hang out with your school friends and you were partiers, like you're more likely to engage in that behavior because that's how you relate to each other, like that's how those social relationships are formed around these behaviors. So I think there's some of that stuff in it. Also, it's just fun. Like a lot of women, and I mean, of course there's male Hanson fans, hello friends, we know you're there. Yeah, no shame, you're all welcome. But I mean, especially for women, and especially of the age that we're at, you know, who've been on this ride for a long time, I guess, of loving music, it's so rare you get a space to be yourself and just let go. Like, as women who are working, who are mothers, who are wives, who are caring for their aging parents, who like women have a lot of emotional labor to do around everything in life. And if you get one evening to just go back to the joy of being 15, like celebrate it. Do you know what I mean? Like, of course, maybe don't get super sick, but I just mean like, it's so rare to find a space in your life where you can just let go and be in love with music. And I think there's a gendered criticism about this behavior in women, and especially young women, but women in general, that, you know, they scream and they cry and they're so emotional. Have you ever been to a football match? Right? There are men there. They're all done up in their colours and their scarves. They're crying when their team wins. They're crying when they score a goal. They're cheering. They're hugging each other. It's emotion. It's the same. It's the same thing. It's just that when women do it, there seems to be this weird gendered of like, it's so crazy. You know how women are. It's about expressing love for something that fills up your cup. Yeah. So it's like, it's just interesting to see the juxtaposition of those behaviors. Men do it too. They love this stuff. It's just in a different shape. It's a football instead of, you know, Taylor Hanson's beautiful golden locks. But I'm just, I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, it's a precious place to be able to be yourself and just let go and love music in a way that you haven't been able to access in a really long time. So I think there's like personal reasons, there's psychological reasons, but I don't know, yell the lyrics to your favorite song, like hold your friend's hand and have a cry, like it's okay, like that's the joy of pop.
I think you're so spot on, because you know, a lot of us spend a lot of money, and even there are some that will dedicate, you know, all their leave, or they work to be able to do the world tours. Do you know what I mean? And they get so much flack.
That's amazing. That's so dedicated. Oh my God.
It is friggin' amazing. And good on them, and full permission to be able to do that, versus someone who, like you were saying, a male, and perhaps their football team is playing in a different country in the A-League or something, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And they've gone, you know, full scarf, gear, all the merch. They've gone to Italy. They've put down, you know, a large amount of money from the house deposit to go and watch the band, probably alone, you know, without, you know, all this sort of stuff, and no one would even blink an eyelid. But if you are head to toe Hanson merch and you've worked your ass off to go and just have a bloody good time, and you're a female and you're following a band, particularly a band like Hanson. I don't know if people would do it for something like Metallica. Again, that's probably, and I'm sure there are males that do that for more.
Absolutely. We talked about Metallica last night, actually. It was funny you brought them up. But yeah, I just mean, like, it's weirdly gendered that you're allowed to behave this way in this situation, and it's like, that's just, sport is life and or whatever it is. But then in this other situation, there's like these weird tensions about how people should behave. And I mean, this was, you could trace that back to the Beatles, right? Of like the girls going insane. That they had this music that they could relate to that was for them, and they just never seen women behave that way before, and they wanted to, you know, societally, that's not how women should behave. And of course, we've come a long way from that, but I do still think that there's like these gendered assumptions yes. about yeah. women and music, especially pop music. Yeah. You know?
I've got two lines of thought on that. My first is, I'll just quickly circle back to the Beatles. So I did watch the Elvis movie recently, the Baz Luhrmann one.
That's just the biopic.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm learning a lot about Elvis that perhaps I didn't know before. And one particular one that I found really interesting was they didn't want him, so America really didn't want him playing because he was making women behave not like, in their eyes, women. So they were starting to move their bodies in crazy ways. They were starting to scream and lose control of themselves whenever Elvis came on. And America tried to shut that down very quickly. This was not okay. This was not appropriate. And it's really not that long ago in the scheme of things. So we might still be sort of feeding in the back of that a little bit as we move through these new cycles. But I will preface it by saying too, but you don't seem to see males fainting and screaming and being front row. And again, I might be completely just not at the right places, but it does seem to be a female gendered thing, particularly with musicians. And I did a little bit of research on why that would be, because I think females get shit for it where males don't, and there's a divide there. But uniquely, or I suppose historically, women show up at those Beatles concerts and they're the ones fainting and vomiting and screaming and throwing their bodies and themselves at the band. Whereas, you know, males maybe tend to, only talking about music, because you're right, they do it at footy and stuff, at sports. It does seem to have a little bit of a divide. So is there something in that? Because my research told me on Google that was particularly for women, almost like they were feeling, in terms of like their sexuality, a connection, and it was a safe space, like we talked about, to be able to explore that without the physical. So that emotion of feeling attracted to people, but you didn't actually have to do anything about it because there's no risk going to be physical with that person. And it was feelings that you could explore within your own body, particularly as teenage girls. That was a safe space. So do you reckon that could lead into it a little bit as well? Or is Google?
Yeah, no, I do. I do think that that's definitely part of it. And it certainly was the case in the Beatles and every pop band, like Elvis too. I mean, like when he was on the Milton Berle show, Tim, they refused to shoot him from the waist down. Like they were just like, we're not having this. Like that's, you know, and I think, you know, in terms of like, oh, well, men don't cry and faint and that kind of stuff. I do think, I mean, without going into it, that's the patriarchy, right? Like men are told they're not allowed to be emotional in those very specific ways. You know, like they are, like, we need to break that stuff down, obviously, in a bigger way. But, like, you're not, they're not.
Men get aggressive emotionally,
They're in a mosh pit punching each other.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Have you seen, you know, like the death wall or whatever? Have you seen a mosh pit or, you know, where people are, you know, like stage diving and that sort of stuff? That's the same expression of emotion. It's, I want to be here. I'm with my people. I can't control myself. I need to like writhe around in this very specific way, but still be masculine about it so it's not weird. I just think those feelings come from a similar place, but they're just expressed in different kind of bodily ways, maybe. And there might be some more like kind of cultural theorists who are much better at kind of explaining like the physicality, like the embody, I guess what we'd say, the embodiment of music in that sort of way. But yeah, I just think there's a lot of reasons why, okay, so a you know, maybe a fellow fan won't faint and cry and scream or whatever, but they've got their own version of that where they can express themselves in a way that, like, that's the thing about like a music concert, like you can kind of, there are a lot of rules, I guess, in the way that we're supposed to behave. And as long as you're not hurting anyone and, you know, you're being respectful, it's like you could let loose and dance in a way that maybe you can't in your regular life. And that's, I guess, what makes live music really precious.
But did space, you guys,
you know, like if you were just at the bus stop, maybe it wouldn't really work out, you know, but if you're in the right place, you can let it out.
Did you guys watch that Woodstock 99 doco? By chance.
I haven't watched it yet, but I do know about what happened at Woodstock in 99, but I need to be like, you know, I'm ready for cringe.
It's really Yeah, no, I think you'll find so much resonance to it, and it really leads into what we're talking about at that particular time. And the reason that I'm leaning into it just really quickly now is because it was a connection to male emotion taking over at that particular festival, and the way that they expressed it, which was through lighting fires, pulling down signs, you know, theft, urination, you know, those all that sort of stuff. You don't want to play into the patriarchy, and you don't want to say that's typical male behavior versus typical female behavior, but it is a really interesting little piece of history that talks about what was happening at that time. We've talked a little bit about how music connects with emotion, and they had a lot of artists on, like Korn, Red Hot Chili Peppers, that they're might have been Blink 182, I can't remember, particular bands at that time that were very, it was Limp Bizkit. It was very much male-driven ego and angry. You know, you want to smoke weed and you want to stay in bed, so, you know, F society, that sort of thing. And a lot of males played into that. And they were really, that made them angry, right? Because, yeah, I do want to smoke weed and I do just want to stay in bed. I can't believe I've got to go and have a job, right? And it really made it.
I mean, to be fair. Don't do drugs. I know. I just want a cup of tea and I want to go to bed. Yeah. Can I have that instead?
But, yeah, it's interesting you bring up those kind of bands, like the ones, because I feel like, but there's an element to which, like, something like Hanson is kind of pandering to the fans, like that they're giving the fans what they want in terms of representing the feelings and things that they have in their lives. And what JD mentioned before about, like, you know, the experiences that are in the music are similar to the ones that the fans have. And I think, like, so you can sort of say that's a bit of pandering rather than trying to be very artistic. But I think that's the same. You can say exactly the same stuff about, yeah, the Limp Bizkit and Metallica and, like, Korn and those bands who are kind of pandering to that kind of male teenage testosterone kind of thing going on.
I mean, I think that word is used in a derogatory sense, but I think more it's like they're purposely relating, maybe, rather than like I'm doing this because of money or whatever. Yeah. Like, I get the feeling that Metallica were quite genuine about that stuff back in the day, in the same way that Hanson was. But, well, they seem to have a weird sense of humor about themselves, I guess. But I think you're right. I think it's like, you know, there's a lot of patriarchal and misogynist and sort of like themes around these kinds of behaviors and how they are accepted or tolerated or talked about. And Hanson are a really interesting example of that because of the way they presented, because of their fan base, because of the kind of music that they made, you know? So it's funny. I wonder how things would have been for them if they had broken when they were in their mid-20s and they didn't have that early period of them being kids, in that they had to fight for legitimacy in a way that maybe somebody who fight for legitimacy in a way that maybe they wouldn't if they had broken when they were like I said in their mid-20s or something and taken off. I wonder in the alternate universe if some of those debates would be very different. My gut is yes. But
Well, JD and Tim, I'm going to wrap it up. It has been such an interesting discussion, and I thank you both so much for your incredible insights. It's been so appreciated. So thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, my gosh. This was a joy. My 13-year-old self inside thinks she's so cool right now. So thank you, Megan. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we can talk again soon.
Definitely, likewise. All right, thanks, guys.
Bye. You're welcome.